Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. We continue open lines for about 25 minutes. Then Wesley Smith joins us from the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. It is time for an update on the Terry Schiavo case. Governor Jeb Bush of Florida has finally, at long last, and I think probably bending to pressure from the many, and we're not talking about just a few, we're talking about thousands and thousands of communiques he has received from people like you. He has finally decided that he will file an amicus memorandum, a friend of the court memorandum, urging the courts to carry out a preliminary injunction against another judge's order that would have required that Terry Schiavo be starved and dehydrated to death under her husband's supervision. We'll find out what Wesley has to say about this in about 25 minutes. Father David Moyer joins us then. A little later, president of Forward in Faith North America. He joins us from Dallas, where they are meeting together in a conference called A Place to Stand, the American Anglican Council and other conservative Episcopalians, wondering what to do now that the Episcopal Church USA has broken with worldwide Anglicanism. What will they do? What can they do? We'll get an update in the very last part of Issues Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's go back to the phones. People are waiting. Sandy is on the line from Alton. Sandy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really don't think we can appeal to the secular mind. We have to maybe, with biblical admonitions, maybe look at cause and effect and human behavior in society and whether certain behaviors are considered unhealthy or unnatural, deviant. And I think our laws and historically these behaviors, the homosexual behaviors, along with voyeurism, pedophilia, and exhibitionism, these are harmful to society as a whole. We had an experiment of these types of behaviors in the free love era, you know, come to pass, and we're suffering with illegitimacy and everything that rises out of that. And so I think this basis has to be established and appealed to rather than a thus saith the Lord and then bring that in at another time. And I'll never forget, I think I said this before, but J. Everett Koop, former Surgeon General, had made a statement at the AIDS awareness back 20 years ago that he had said anal sex is so dangerous it should never even be performed, even with condoms. And these statements, I think, have to be applied to issues today. Thank you,
Sandy. Now, Sandy raises, and I knew sooner or later someone would probably raise this as well. Now, this is legitimate. If you're going to argue entirely in the civil realm, you're going to say, okay, we're not going to open up the Bibles. We're just going to argue from kind of the, is it in your interest to engage in this behavior long-term standpoint? And there is no doubt about it. Sandy is right. Only the most dishonest of medical researchers will say, look, homosexual behavior is harmless. The vast majority of the research does indicate that it not only is harmful in the short term, but it is devastatingly harmful to those who practice it in the long term, and that is increased rates of various kinds of cancer. Of course, there is always HIV and AIDS. The transmission rates there are through the roof. But let's always remember, not exclusive to homosexuals. Where AIDS is actually breaking out in epidemic proportions in sub-Saharan Africa right now, it is primarily being transmitted by heterosexuals. So it's an equal opportunity killer. But there are other things. There are not only shorter lifespans, markedly shorter lifespans. We're talking about 10, 20 years shorter lifespans. So she has a valid point, except I can hear Ellen Goodman saying this. Yes, yes, that is the result of the promiscuous engaging, the engaging in promiscuous homosexual behavior, which is risky. Yes, it's risky, just like promiscuous heterosexual behavior is risky. And she would say, and I'm speaking here as the devil's advocate or the Ellen Goodman's advocate, I would say, that's precisely why we need same-sex unions. We need to bring homosexuality out of the closet out of the dark shadows into the light of day where people can see it for a normal and acceptable behavior. And we need to give it all the benefits that heterosexual behavior has, that is the institution of marriage and union, so that what was once a furtive and promiscuous behavior now can become an open and monogamous behavior. And then they argue you will see those rates drop. Now, I don't know if that argument is entirely valid, but I can hear it being, haven't you heard this? When someone says homosexuality is dangerous to those who practice it, the response is, well, that's because homosexuality has been so ostracized and kept in the closet that it's encouraged promiscuity. And if only we had gay marriage, then we would see the risk factors, because we wouldn't have people jumping from bed to bed, which is always risky. We'd see those risk factors drop. Stan is calling from his car. Stan, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, thank you. Before I ask a question, just a quick statement of, if all you have to do is look at the history of the Roman Empire, and the last thing before their fall was actual, just total, complete sexual promiscuity, homosexuality, and the rest of it. But my main question is, what difference have we in this country now from what Paul, in his letters to the Corinthians, was talking about? And those societies are dead. They went the way of all societies like that. The only thing that stands is the word of Christ, and we have to exhibit it. And if they want to see it, the Holy Spirit will open their eyes. But if they don't want to see it, we can't do anything about it.
Okay, Stan, thank you. That's kind of the, well, you know, what's going to be is going to be. Que sera, sera viewpoint. And you know what? That has some merit with me, because I do agree with Stan only in this. This is a battle we're going to lose. And I'm talking about cultural conservatives, not the church. The church is not going to lose any battles. The church has victory, period, in Christ. This is a battle that cultural conservatives are going to lose. And I would cite precisely the same history that he cites. Civilization after civilization has risen and has fallen into dust. Not always because of homosexual behavior. Sometimes it's contributed to it. But none has lasted. Some, they've reached their peak. They've shone brightly for a long time or a short time. But we're going to lose this one. The church will remain. Christ's word will remain. But I think as far as the issue of whether or not the traditional family, as it is defined in the mind of the culture, is in for change, that horse left the barn a long time ago. And not because of homosexuality, largely because of divorce, to tell you the truth. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. But in the meantime, do we have answers to questions like, what's so bad about it? Why does it harm the traditional family? Ellen Goodman says this. What exactly, and she is quoting here from Focus on the Family, that gay marriage would be, quote, a devastating and potentially fatal blow to the traditional family. She asks, what exactly is so devastating about a couple living together in this kind of love? How on earth could their commitment or their marriage be fatal to my own marriage? How could their desire to adopt and raise children undermine heterosexual families? Your answers to those questions. How would you respond to Ellen Goodman? Kathy's calling from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor. Thank you for taking my call. I guess what I would say to her is, if she thinks legitimizing it legally would bring people out of the closet, and they would, it sounded like, too, your one caller was talking about, was able to justify it because it was going, his particular relationship, I think his name was John, was loving, and he wanted to get married before God. And so somehow that was going to legitimize it. But, you know, that's just, to me, that doesn't make any sense, because you can do that with anything that would be considered a deviant behavior. Try to rationalize it, legitimize it, make it sound like it's not so bad, bring it out in the open, and say that society should accept this. And I just think it really doesn't make any logical sense.
You know, Kathy, you have put in one brief paragraph that rather long conversation that I had with, it was Bob, right there in a nutshell. What about the rest of you? How would you answer Ellen Goodman when she says, look, everyone says it's going to be bad for the traditional family. How? How is it going to be bad for the traditional family? Let's put it in kind of neighborhood terms. You've got a couple, a man and a man, who move into the house next door to you. They've been a couple for 15 years. They cook out, they have friends over, they go to movies, they go to work, they come home, they watch football, they do whatever, but they've been a gay couple for 15 years, and, you know, they're hit that middle age, they're not out doing the clubs, they're not going to the bathhouses, they're not roaming the streets. They are the model same-sex marriage, even if they don't have legal recognition. And you're talking to them over the fence one day, you've got your wife, your kids, and your dog, and they simply ask you, look, I know how you feel about this, I know what you think about this, but what about us threatens you or what you have? Honest question. Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, hello. About Ellen Goodman's question, how could it harm the heterosexual family? It seems that if you have a gay couple and they adopt a child, male or female, the child is going to grow up and see that something's different in his family, his friends, his classmates, whatever. The bottom line, I think, is that it could cause neuroses, anguish, questioning, doubt, uncertainty, in other words, mental abuse against the poor child. That's how I see it.
Bill, thank you very much. That's very important. Now, that's actually, he actually has gotten to the first point that I wanted to get to when I wrap this up, and that is there are individual consequences, especially when it comes to the adopting of children. There are individual consequences. If, as all research prior to about 25 years ago indicated that, and this was raised by Craig earlier when he called, homosexual behavior is in fact a learned social pathology, then to expose a child to a constant life, no matter how loving and well-adjusted and they pay their bills kind of a thing is, if it is a learned social pathology, it's not good to expose kids to this on a regular basis, especially when they're calling those people dad and dad or mom and mom. So it has individual consequences, no doubt about that. There's more to it. Miles is calling from his car. Miles, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I appreciate what you're doing by trying to take this point by point. But I wonder if we've already lost when we do that. I wonder if we shouldn't just be a little more like John the Baptist and just go straight to the scriptures where this is absolutely condemned. Just personally for me, having this stuff talked about and it becoming more and more openly discussed is a nightmare. I don't want my children to hear your show today. So I think you're fighting the cultural battle when you're trying to take them on rationally. Even though every rational point we make is right, people that have gone this way have already shut their eyes and their hearts and their minds to just natural knowledge. That's all I have to say.
All right, Miles, thank you. Look, and I've said it before, folks, when we're talking about subjects that are inappropriate for children, feel free to turn us off. But that doesn't mean your kids shouldn't know what this is. It is your place as parents to talk to them, and you do that as you see fit. The last thing I want to do is shelter my children from the reality of what they will find in the culture, so that when they find it, they are completely unprepared to evaluate it for what it is, to understand that it is, in fact, deviant and is, in fact, sinful, and leave them ill-equipped to respond to it. you know, I've encountered this as a parent. There is hardly a sitcom you can turn on television today that doesn't have as a main character someone who is openly and very clearly gay. Now, maybe the sitcom is the worst place to expose your kids to this, but they need to be prepared. And probably a lot earlier than we did. Kathy's calling from her car. Kathy might have to be last today. We'll see. Kathy, welcome to Issues, Etc. And Kathy's gone. Wait, I think we've got her back now. Kathy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, Todd?
Yes.
I agree with the last gentleman. I think it's getting totally disgusting. It's absolutely, the Lord said we're not to talk about these things that are done in the dark, in the open. And it's so sad because my child, who we live next door to a homosexual, and his son was already being raped by him and polluted in his mind. And one thing I told my son, never let another boy touch you. And when this little boy tried to touch him, he immediately told the boy to stop, and he came home and told me. And I dealt with the father, told him to get out of the neighborhood, otherwise I was going to report him to the police. This is disgusting what's happening to our children and how they can be molested right from their next-door neighbor.
Kathy, you gave your son excellent advice. No one's disagreeing with that. In fact, you should have reported him anyway. It's not good enough to send him out of the neighborhood. Say, sorry, bud, get out of the neighborhood, and I'm going to report you. It's a crime. Whether it's committed by a child or an adult homosexual, it's a crime. You might not get the police to do anything about it, but for heaven's sakes, you can still try. Look, we can make the argument and respond to the Ellen Goodmans of this world saying, look, there are individual consequences here. Don't live in, you know, don't put on your rose-colored glasses and think that children who are raised with two mommies or two dads are not going to, and especially with all the presuppositions that go along with that, are not going to be harmed by this. Maybe not physically harmed. Maybe not even psychologically harmed, but harmed the way that harm really gets to us, and that is being told and shown again day after day that what the conscience says so clearly is sin isn't. Damage to that child's conscience alone is enough reason. You know what? Ellen Goodman knows it's wrong, too. That's why she fights so vigorously in favor of it. She knows that this behavior is wrong. The guilty knowledge of her conscience cannot be denied. As much as she approves and celebrates and dances at her cousin's wedding, she does it all to spite her conscience. We know that. She doesn't. We know that. Now hold that thought for a moment. We can also argue that there is a societal harm. That's fine and good. We can. Because we can say, look, it's only logical to take something that has a very exclusive definition, man and woman, and to broaden it to include other things like man and man, woman and woman, and then who knows where it's going to go after that, cannot be good for society because we lose something. Society doesn't gain something by broadening the definition of marriage to include homosexual couples. It loses something. It loses what we've been calling in this conversation the whole notion of the family. So that legally, philosophically, in our educational system, suddenly the term family becomes meaningless. What is lost? The term family. It's lost not because it isn't used or not defined, but because it is so broadly defined that it doesn't mean anything. Here's a good example. If I take anything and define it too broadly, the term becomes useless. Now, everyone agrees that the term family is good, and family, no matter how you define it, is good. But if there is no objective definition, and I would argue an exclusive definition of family, we can call family good all we want. We're just making sounds. We're really saying that everything is good. To declare the family a social good is of necessity to declare things not the family social ills. Do you understand what I'm saying? The reason we say the family is a good thing is because we are by necessity also saying, and things that are not family, like children running the streets with no parents, women forced to raise their children without fathers because dad simply takes the jungle attitude toward procreation. Those things are social ills. And we can also argue, as some of the callers here have already, that, you know, this is just yet another crack in the edifice of civilization and an indicator of its inevitable collapse. All of those are valid arguments, probably none of which Ellen Goodman will listen to. And I'll tell you why she won't listen. She won't listen because she won't listen to what I mentioned before, the clear testimony of her conscience. You see, if she was listening to her conscience, that God has written into the heart of every man, woman, and child, that this and all the other sins that God has condemned, all of our rebellion against him, is wrong, and although we don't have guilty feelings, we certainly cannot escape guilty knowledge. If she were listening to her conscience, we wouldn't need to argue the social, cultural, individual arguments with her. One of our callers got it right. The reason no answer will suffice is because the wrong question is being asked. Because the issue isn't how this is going to harm the family. Lots of things harm the family. Lots of things harm the family, by the way, that Christians wholeheartedly approve of and do every day, like ignoring your kids and leaving them in daycare and shuttling them off to someone else so that you don't have to look at them. And between school and daycare and all the other things you have them doing, they hardly know who you are, mom and dad. Lots of things harm the family that Christians regularly do and that sometimes the church even encourages them to do. The issue is not whether it's going to harm the family. That's the wrong question. The question is what came up with that caller who called passing through St. Louis on his way to a pastor's conference of gay and lesbian pastors. The question is sin. The only voice that the Christian and the church can have on this ultimately has to be, it doesn't mean we give up on the other arguments, but the only voice that will ultimately make any difference is the one that doesn't say, don't do this because you're going to hurt the family, or don't do this because society will crumble, or don't do this because it will individually harm people. Those are good arguments. They're only stopgap measures. The only argument, the only thing, is the testimony of the law that resonates with that conscience that cannot be ignored. The law that says to every sinner, homosexual and not, your rebellion against God is sin and puts you at odds with him. It's the only word we can speak to this. It's the only word that'll make any difference. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled, A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues, Etc. journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues, Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
Christians, can they believe in millions of years? Answers with Ken Ham, one of the builders of a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, would you ever say that a person who believes in millions of years of history can't be a Christian?
No, I'd certainly never say that. In fact, I believe it's true to say that probably the majority of Christians do believe in millions of years. But I'd say that those Christians who believe in millions of years are undermining biblical authority. In reality, they're destroying the basis of the Christian faith they believe in. See, many Christians don't understand how crucial it is to the Christian faith to reject the millions of years. Now, first, the idea of millions of years came from the belief that fossil layers were laid down over millions of years. To believe this is to accept death and diseases, like cancer, which can be seen in fossil bones, existed before sin. This makes God responsible for death and disease, but the Bible instead blames sin. Second, the Bible's chronology doesn't allow for millions of years. Those who accept long ages have to reinterpret the 6 days of creation to allow for millions of years. This opens a dangerous door by allowing people to reinterpret other parts of the Bible, thus undermining biblical authority. It's a crucial issue indeed.
You can find out why it's so important for Christians to believe that God created in 6 literal days when you go to our very popular website, AnswersRadio.com.
At AM 850 KFUO, weather for St. Louis. Partly cloudy tonight, low of about 60. For Thursday, mostly cloudy. A chance for showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and a high near 76. Right now, scattered clouds and it's 79 in St. Louis. For the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc., an update on the euthanasia case in Florida with Wesley Smith. And another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 between Kings Highway and Hanley, heavy traffic there. Westbound 70 between 270 and the Blanchette Bridge, some slow traffic. Westbound 70 between 170 and the St. Charles Rock Road, heavy traffic there. Southbound 170 before the Club Tower, heavy traffic to 40. Eastbound 40 after Woods Mill, heavy traffic to Mason. Taking a look at the bridges. Eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, stop and go traffic. And northbound 55 after Park Avenue, slow traffic to the Poplar Street Bridge.
In 1 John chapter 2, John says, He, meaning Jesus, is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, and not only for our sins, but also for the sins of the whole world. Then why isn't the whole world saved? We'll ask Professor Reed Lessing next time on our Bible study program, heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back. 10 minutes from now, we'll get a live report from Dallas, where the American Anglican Council is meeting with other conservative Episcopalians trying to determine a course of action and the possible future for conservative Anglicans in the Episcopal Church USA here in the United States. Father David Moyer will join us then from Forward in Faith for that update 10 minutes from now. Until then, Wesley Smith joins us. Another update on the euthanasia case in Florida, the case of Terry Schiavo. Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and author of the book Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. Wesley, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. Wesley, tell us about the latest that has come from the office of Governor Jeb Bush in Florida on this case.
Well, you may recall that the last time I was on, I urged your listeners to contact Jeb Bush and urge that he intervene to try to help save Terry's life, Terry Schiavo's life. Terry, of course, is the cognitively disabled woman who has been ordered dehydrated to death beginning on October 15th. And indeed, not only is her food and water to be stopped, but Judge Greer of the Sixth Circuit Court in Florida has said that she cannot even be allowed to be given medical therapy, which many experts say could wean her from tube feeding and help her improve her condition. That resulted in a federal civil rights lawsuit being filed by Pat Anderson, who is the attorney for Bob Schindler, the father of Terry Schiavo and Terry's mother and brother and sister, alleging that refusing to permit the therapy to allow weaning actually is a violation of Terry's right to life, and a violation of due process of law. Governor Jeb Bush, in part because I believe so many people from around the country contacted him and urged him to act, and I also believe because he has a good heart, filed a remarkable document. He filed an amicus brief in the federal court. This does not make the state of Florida a party, but it puts the governor of the state of Florida on record asking a federal judge to issue an injunction to prevent the implementation of a court order by a state judge. This is very big news. This really moves this case, I believe, into a, at least to me it should, to a new level, because it, now it can no longer be stated, as some of the defenders of the dehydration have asserted, that all of this legal work by Pat Anderson and at the behest of the Schindlers is merely to stall for time. You now have the governor of one of the most important states in this union stating that a state judge activities and court orders is a violation of the Constitution and the right to life of one of Florida's citizens.
Now, before we move on to the particulars, if the judge who is receiving this amicus brief from the governor of Florida takes this seriously and in his capacity as a federal judge rules in favor of the plaintiff in this case, that would be the family of Terry Schiavo minus this husband, Michael, if he rules in favor, is he in fact saying that the constitutional right to life can be asserted in favor of those who are having their lives threatened by their caregivers, as in the case of Michael Schiavo?
I wouldn't quite put it that way. What the judge would be saying if he orders the injunction is not that it is unconstitutional to deprive somebody of tube feeding, because that is deemed a form of medical treatment and is protected by the right to privacy. At least that's the way it is in the state of Florida. But what the judge will be saying is that before you can do that, the person has the right to life to be protected. That is, has the right to see whether or not that person can either eat by mouth or be taught to eat by mouth. It's not a 100% slam dunk for what I would like to see the law be in this country, but it would certainly beat a kick in the pants, if you know what I'm saying. What this is trying to draw a line. There are certain areas that we've already lost at law, and one of those is that people can be dehydrated to death because they're cognitively disabled if they use a feeding tube. At this point, there is no way that that is going to be set aside anytime soon. I'm not saying it could never happen, but you're not going to do that in this case. But what can happen, and what I think will save Terry's life, is a judge can say, as Pat Anderson has, is that when you dehydrate somebody to death, which of course is the way I describe it, there are two distinct steps. One is stopping the tube feeding, which is refusing medical treatment, which a court has already ordered. But the second is refusing mouth sustenance. That is not medical treatment. And everybody has the right not to be killed. Let me read to you how the governor put it in his amicus brief. Quote, the governor submits this memorandum to ensure that the court consider the critical distinction between removing artificial life support and the deliberate killing of a human being by starvation and dehydration. These are two different actions. Now, let me say parenthetically, a lot of your listeners may be upset and say, no, they aren't. But remember, this is a legal brief that is arguing the law, not what the policy should be. I'm noting that instead of being happy and grateful to Jeb Bush for filing this brief, there are a lot of people yelling at him because he's not arguing a policy matter. But this is not the proper vehicle for a policy argument. What Jeb Bush is trying to do is practical, save Terry's life. And rather than throwing brickbats in his direction, I think people who should be calling and thanking him for intervening, because I think this took extraordinary courage. End my parenthetical comment, and let me go on with what Jeb Bush said. The first act is performed according to state law and is allowed under Florida constitutional right to privacy, that is, stopping the tube feeding. The second is prohibited by the right to life enshrined in the Florida and federal constitutions. The governor submits that removal of the feeding tube without first determining by medically accepted means whether the plaintiff can ingest food and water on her own, with or without rehabilitative therapy, constitutes the deprivation of her life without due process of law. This is big. because this case now must be taken very seriously by this federal judge. If the injunction issues to determine whether or not she can obtain therapy and Terry improves and learns how to do that or makes it so that there's no way to call her PVS, persistent vegetative state, her life will have been saved. Now, the problem here is that Jeb Bush and the attorneys for the Schindlers are working in a milieu in which bioethicists and the legal system and the medical intelligentsia have said that it isn't being human that makes a life have value. It's having cognitive capacity. That's called personhood or personhood theory. Here in California, for example, in the Robert Wendland case, the Supreme Court ruled that people who are diagnosed as unconscious do not have the same constitutional rights and protections as those who are conscious. Therefore, in the California case, a man who was injured in an auto accident while he was unconscious did not have the same protections as he had when he woke up and became conscious again 16 months later. This is really a frightening situation. And the thing that's always been very difficult in these cases is that if somebody is diagnosed, as Terry has been, although we all know it's false if you look at the videos of her, as unconscious, we are now beginning to treat those people as somehow different and having less value and less and fewer rights, if any rights, than we treat people who are conscious. And that is the problem here. And this is the milieu in which Bush is filing his brief. And he has done, I believe, what can be done, considering the current state of the law, medical ethics, and the moral situation we find ourselves in this country.
There's another interesting thing right at the outset of the memorandum, and that is, it's a very simple point, but it's one that I think really rings loudly, and that is the governor argues, in light of the seriousness of this matter, and here are the crucial words for me, the inability to remedy an improper outcome.
Right. What he's saying is if she's dead, there's no way to go back and fix what has been lost. So to keep the status quo means keeping her alive until all of this can be checked out. And that's very clear because once Terry dies, how do you remedy that? But if for example, she cannot be given rehabilitation and cannot improve, well, it would still be wrong to dehydrate her, but at least the issue of her receiving the treatment, being denied the treatment that might help her, would have been settled. This is something that is not where we don't have to believe one side of doctors or the other side of doctors. Assuming we get somebody who really wants to rehabilitate Terry, and that's really crucial here because there might be some people who would go through the motions and not actually try to do it. Then at least that issue can be determined empirically because she will have had that opportunity, which she's been denied, by the way, for more than 10 years. And you know, Todd, this is really important to me. I think the way we look at people such as Terry is basically a reflection on the state of our own hearts and souls. I think that people who are cognitively disabled and helpless and defenseless become mirrors to our own state of being. If we look at them and see their humanity and can reach out an unconditional love to them knowing they can't respond to us, then that says one thing about us, it seems to me. But if we look upon them and think, oh, this is not even human, we objectify them, turn them into a thing instead of a human being, and start to think, well, look at those organs there that might be good for other people, which the critical care medicine article that I discussed with you last time I was on the show has done, saying that we should be able to take organs from cognitively disabled people, then I think that says something else about us. And I think the problem and the reason we're having these discussions and the reason I'm having to write my articles and write my books is that our national soul and our national conscience is beginning to look at our fellow brothers and sisters who are helpless and defenseless and vulnerable, and instead of seeing humanity, they're seeing something else. But it's not their humanity that's at issue. Perhaps it's our own.
Wesley, if this injunction is granted by the federal courts, the question will still remain, of course, who should be her legal guardian? Could it be that this injunction could be granted, but Michael Schiavo remains her guardian and just simply gets another bite at the apple to try and kill off his wife?
Well, yes, that could happen. And there has to be some action continuing in that regard to try to point out to the courts that somebody who wants somebody dead and who has conflicts of interest in that regard, as we've discussed previously, both financial and personal, since he wants to remarry and he's having children with his fiance, should not be the person in charge of this person's health care. But those are steps for a later day. The first step is to make sure the dehydration doesn't begin on October 15th as currently ordered. That's what the injunction would accomplish. The second step would be to make sure that we start getting therapy for Terry from somebody, a professional who has a real desire to help her get better. Then I think at the same time, there has to be some legal action to say, listen, Michael is not the person who should be entitled to be in charge of his wife's care.
Finally, Wesley, is there anything more that our listeners can do? I know that many of them did contact the governor's office in Florida after our conversation previous to this. Is there anything more that we can do?
I would like them to contact Governor Bush, and I've done this. I've been very hard on Governor Bush, as you know. I wrote him an email and thanked him for having the states, for having the courage and to be a statesman, because I think this was a statesmanlike act. There are a lot of people criticizing him because they don't feel he's gone far enough. I don't share that criticism. This is a remarkable document and a remarkable act of courage. And I think everybody who criticized him, and properly so when all he would do is write a letter, should now contact him and thank him. Because if all we do is complain to our elected officials and don't show our appreciation when they act properly, it seems to me that that is a disincentive for them to act properly. So I would hope everybody who wrote would now say, write back and say, thank you, you have intervened, you have done right by Terry Schiavo.
Wesley Smith, thank you for this update, and please, you are a valuable asset on this case and others, keeping us informed, and also your voice is definitely being heard, and we're glad in this case it was. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of the book Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope, From Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. And I do encourage you folks, all you got to do is go to your search engine on the web, type in State of Florida or Florida State. You will find there a link to the governor's office. Email Governor Jeb Bush, say thank you for taking this courageous step in filing your friend of the court brief on behalf of Terry Schiavo. For the remainder of the program, we're going to be getting an update from the American Anglican Council Conference in Dallas, A Place to Stand. Father David Moyer is our guest, president of Forward in Faith North America. He is in Dallas and joins us now. Father Moyer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's good to be here.
What's happened today down in Dallas at this meeting of the American Anglican Council?
Well, a growing sense of uniformity and resolve that we're coming together to petition the primates of the Anglican Communion to act decisively against the Episcopal Church at their meeting next week in London.
I understand that a bishop spoke today at the conference and received a standing ovation. What was the nature of this?
Yeah, that was Bishop Duncan of Pittsburgh, and he really threw down the gauntlet. And he said, you know, enough is enough. We cannot continue on being aligned with a church that denies the historic teachings of the church, and we will do everything we can to preserve classical biblical Anglicanism for our children and our children's children, cost what it may.
The Pittsburgh diocese spoke earlier before this conference officially in repudiating the action of the Episcopal Church USA this
right.
summer. Did the Texas diocese also do this?
Yes, the Diocese of Fort Worth adopted the same resolutions as Pittsburgh did.
Any other diocese spoke out officially before this conference?
I think South Carolina did. But principally, Pittsburgh and Fort Worth were the strongest in their resolutions.
So, what decisions have been taken today, if any, that move this conversation forward, at least with respect to the people who have gathered there with the American Anglican Council?
Well, nothing. The official statement will come out tomorrow morning, but I can say without hesitation that there will be a very strong statement made tomorrow morning that will immediately go to the press that is saying that this group of Episcopalians will not tolerate being part of a church that has removed itself from the Christian religion, and we will do everything in our power, working internationally, to begin a new day of mission and work.
Have you received any word from Anglicans worldwide of encouragement for your efforts there?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, the majority of the primates, the archbishops of the Anglican Communion, there are 38 of them. The majority of them are clearly kind of rooting for us, and we're rooting for them. We're really partners in this, and I really believe, and I've been in the trenches for many years, that next week in London, it's going to be a new day for the whole Anglican Communion, especially the Episcopal Church.
In the best of all possible worlds, Father Moyer,
yeah.
What will be the eventual outcome of this meeting and others like it?
It will be the best scenario would be that the primates of the Anglican Communion declare that the Episcopal Church has removed itself from the Anglican Communion. They've severed themselves from that, and so the primates would then recognize an emerging body of faithful bishops, priests, deacons, and lay people in America and say, these are the true Anglicans in North America.
Is that wishful thinking, or does that actually
no.
have a possibility of occurring?
Oh, I think it has a strong possibility of happening. Absolutely. I think we're on the verge of it happening.
Do you think the primates will do it in this coming meeting, or do you think, and not to impugn the Anglican way of doing things, do you
right.
think that they will say, well, we're very close to the events, let us have a little time to think about it and to discuss it, we'll talk about it maybe a year from now?
No, I think they know that we're at a critical moment, and the Episcopal Church is hemorrhaging, and if they do not make a decisive decision now, next week, that there will be consequences, very serious consequences. So I think they will not delay in making some type of judgment next week.
Tell us about the lay voice there at that conference and in the Episcopal Church on this issue.
Well, the laity are the dominant people here in numbers, young and old, men and women from all over the United States. And they've really had it. I mean, they love their church, and they really want her to be strong. But they have finally realized with this election and approval of an openly homosexual bishop that they simply cannot tolerate this, and they won't be part and parcel of a church that upholds this.
What do you make of Frank Griswold, presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, who
yeah.
surely must be able to read the tea leaves and the statements of the primates as well as you guys can? What do you make of
yeah.
his, it seems to be, insistence that, number one, Scripture does not condemn the practice of homosexuality, and number two, God has this unfolding truth that the church simply has to kind of keep up with as a moving target?
I know. I think Frank Griswold is in a state of denial. It's like a serious alcoholic who just will not admit that he has a drinking problem. I don't understand it. I mean, it's so obvious that it's all falling apart, but he just, I don't know if it's a blindness, a stubbornness, a fear. I really, Todd, I don't understand why he maintains his position.
Father Moyer, do you have any sense at this point, in terms of numbers,
yes.
what the actual division in American Episcopal Church will look like if the primates say, you have your own province, now you have a safe place to stand over
right.
against the Episcopal Church USA?
Right. I think I don't know, but I do know that there are so many, it's the silent majority, that there are so many men, women, and children in the pews throughout the Episcopal Church who are waiting for something decisive to happen. And once they see the leadership going in a new direction, they will jump on the train. I think the majority of Episcopalians when push comes to shove, favor what we're trying to do here, the majority.
And if it were possible for there to be this kind of allowance on the part of the primates,
yes.
Does that mean suddenly you've got a brand spanking new Episcopal Church in the United States with no problems and no divisions and no disagreements anymore?
No. Unfortunately, one of the things we're wrestling with here is the ordination of women, because there is a division on that. There are so-called Orthodox conservative Anglicans who are divided on that. Of course, my organization that I'm president of opposes the ordination of women. So that's something we're going to have to work out as time goes on.
Very quickly, with only 30 seconds, what's on the agenda for tomorrow there in Dallas?
The agenda for tomorrow is the release of the statement that will go to the primates next week, and people having the opportunity to sign on to it. I think there will be much prayer, much invoking of the Holy Spirit's power upon us in the weeks ahead, and a pledge of solidarity to keep our hands to the plow.
Father David Moyer, keep up the good work, the rest of you down there in Dallas, and we hope to hear from you soon. Good news. Thank you for being our guest.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Bye-bye.
Father David Moyer is president of Forward in Faith North America. He joins us from Dallas, where there is a meeting of the American Anglican Council and other concerned conservative Anglicans following the approval of an openly gay bishop this summer in the Episcopal Church USA. If you'd like to visit Forward in Faith on the web, their website, forwardinfaith.com. It's all one word, forwardinfaith.com. Tomorrow on the program, the heart and soul of the Reformation. What was the issue? The issue? The sinner's justification. That was the heart and the soul of the Reformation. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Our guest, Dr. Martin Nolan of the Concordia Historical Institute. This continues our conversations based upon our new Issues Etc. book of the month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. In the seconds left, let me remind you how you can get this book for yourself. Call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or go online tonight to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on the Issues Etc. book of the month for October, Lift High This Cross. That conversation with Dr. Martin Nolan tomorrow on Issues Etc. as we look at the heart and the soul of the Reformation. Get the book, read along with us as we study it here on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.